Thank you, Phil, and thank you, Cranley. And good morning, everybody, and it's great to see so many visitors here. Great to see Tony here. How are you? Did you bring Stephanie? Yeah, happy birthday, Stephanie, for a couple of weeks ago, love, wherever you are. Hey? Yep. So we missed the birthday greetings for Stephanie because she also hasn't been here for a couple of weeks, but she's here this morning. Can I ask everybody this morning to have a pen and a piece of paper ready to write things on? Because sometime through the exhort, I'm going to ask you to actually pen down some thoughts. And you may or may not wish to share them with me, but that's up to you. I'd love to hear them if you do want to share them with us. It's always a challenge putting an exhortation together, wondering what to do and what subject to speak on. Especially since we've had a number of really top exhorts recently, and I'm thinking particularly of our brother Joe's Blue Ribbon exhort he gave, which he gave again at the boys' camp just recently. Does anybody remember what Joe's exhortation was about? Joe, you're disqualified, you might answer. Love. Oh? And what was the subject, what was the basis of his exhortation? Where did he, what was he reading? 1 Corinthians 13, okay. So what I want to do is I want to build on Joe's exhort, if I can, and I want you to work with me this morning. This is going to be a workshop class, a workshop format, where you can interact with me, and I'm going to ask you questions, and we're going to lead through this subject of love. But I want to start by posing a question. If I were to write these words up, a hole in the soul, what does that mean to you? If I were to say that I have a hole in the soul, or I talk about somebody that has a hole in their soul, what does that mean to you?
Empty.
Empty? Okay, what's empty?
Soul,
yeah. Something missing out of the life, yes.
Spiritually ill.
Not complete. That's right. Over here?
Spiritually ill.
Spiritually ill. That's an interesting one because Paul speaks about that in 1 Corinthians 11, doesn't he? He says, many are sick, weak and sickly among you, and some sleep. Okay? A hole in the soul. What's it mean to you? To be empty? To be incomplete?
Lack of meaning and purpose.
Lack of meaning and purpose. You know, we live in a world full of people who can be described as having a hole in their soul. And it's very possible to be sitting right here this morning in this meeting, vibrant as Pine Rivers is, with our Bible classes and our studies and our interaction and our fellowship, and to be sitting here and still experience a hole in the soul. And if you are feeling somewhat empty in your life, either this morning or at some other times through the week or lonely nights or whatever, don't feel bad. Rejoice in the fact that you can identify that there is something missing. You see, we live in a world which gives us a challenge. What is it that we most want out of life? Is it belonging or belongings? Which one means the most to us? The things that we surround our lives and fill our lives with, our houses, our boats, our cars, our aeroplanes, and I'm not pointing to anybody in particular say that, because I love aeroplanes, I love boats, I love cars, and I work hard, or my share of those things. But what is it that brings the ultimate satisfaction in our lives? You tell me. What is it that brings the ultimate
satisfaction? A sense of love and belonging.
A sense of love and belonging. So life is not so much about belongings as it is about belonging. You see, along with belonging are other words that we really, really need to experience in our life. There's acceptance, isn't there? We
We all want to be accepted for the people that we are at this moment. Okay? Every human being's greatest need is to be loved, to be accepted, to be validated, and to be empowered. Now when we're empowered, what does that mean? Well, that means that we have a potential, don't we? We have something within us that can be empowered, that can drive us to greater things for the future. Now I'm going to put to you something this morning, which you might find a little difficult to grasp or to embrace right at this point in time. I know there's some in this room that won't have a problem with what I'm about to say. But I hope by the time the invitation is finished and we've gotten to the point where we're going to take the emblems, we can see the point of what I'm about to say. It is absolutely impossible to accept another human being unless you first accept yourself. That's the thesis, that's the basis of my invitation this morning. We must first love ourselves before we can love one another. Does everybody agree with that? Okay? We must first love ourselves before we can love one another. And it's absolutely great. We've got some students down here on the floor who are taking notes in technicolor. It is great. What is it that most of us live in, though? Do we live in acceptance or do we live in some other state? Denial, yes. Who was the first person in the Bible to live in denial? Moses. They put him in a chorus in denial. Okay, that wasn't what I was thinking of, actually. What state do we normally live in? It's not a state of acceptance. What's the opposite? Or what is an opposite? Yeah, a state of rejection. That's true. That is very true. What else?
It'll be the fear of rejection.
Ah, that's it. That's the word I'm thinking of. Fear. Rightio? The fear. Most human beings live in a state of fear. A fear of being what? Judged? A fear of being rejected? A fear of being criticised? Excuse my spelling. Criticised is a C in there somewhere. Okay? Criticised? A fear of being blamed? Okay? A fear of being cast away? Or cast aside? Or even cast out? Now what did Jesus say concerning that fear, that last one, the fear of being cast out? What did he say? All who come to me, finishes, I will in no wise cast out. There's a verse in the Bible somewhere that talks about the fact that perfect love actually casts out something. It casts out fear. Now where is that found? Do you know where it's found? Here's a bit of a challenge for you. Your memory verses? It must be in John. Okay, that's a good start. And it must be in the Epistle of John to give you a bit of a head start. Okay? So let's go to the Epistle of John. Okay, and I'm looking at verse... Anybody see it in chapter 4? Verse I'm looking for?
Verse
18. Okay, can I share that with us, please? Can you ever call that out?
There's no fear in love. Perfect love drives out fear. Because fear has to do with pain. The one who fears is not made perfect in love.
Right. So, John tells us that if we have a hole in our soul, that is, if we have a sense of fear, because we fear being rejected by our friends, our peers, our family, our workmates, our colleagues in church, or Jesus at the judgment seat, right? We fear being judged, by our family, by our marriage partners, by our children, by our work colleagues. We fear being criticised by all of the above. We fear being blamed when things go wrong. I grew up with a father who loved to blame. It was always my fault that I was driving the tractor when the piston came out the side of the block. And forever after, that tractor was known as the tractor that Cliff was driving when the piston came out the side of the block. You know, it was just one of those things. He had to blame somebody for everything that went wrong, not the fact that it failed mechanically, and these things do those things. Okay, we might fear being cast away, or cast aside, or cast out. We struggle with this, don't we? Fear is something which is part of the hole in the soul that we have because we were all born with a hole in the soul. Young Samuel over here, I'm going to use him as an example throughout the meeting, if you don't mind, Sarah. Okay. Young Samuel here has been born beautiful as he is, perfectly formed as he is, 5 fingers, 5 toes, on every hand and foot, correct? Okay. Is that so? No, that last one together, right? He has been born incomplete. Okay, he has a hole in his soul, just like we all did when we were his age. There are two Bible verses that I'm thinking of that tell us that we're actually born with a hole in the soul. I want you to go to Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13. Have a look at this first verse. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13. It says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. So after Solomon has gone through the whole range of human experience to find out what fills the hole in the soul, that's what Ecclesiastes is all about. What is it that fills me up and makes me complete? Is it big building projects? Is it being king? Is it having lots of women in the harem? Is it feasts and parties? Is it, he could say that, Tony. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and the other way around. You know, he could say that. We don't want too many women in our harem, but he had it. But he found out that didn't fill the hole in the soul. Okay? Multiple partners doesn't do that. He checked out everything under the sun to see what it was that could complete a man. And this is what his conclusion is at the end of verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter, he says. Fear God. Now that doesn't mean, like, I'm scared. What's that word fear?
Reverence.
Reverence or respect. Okay? It's what we have with those who we treat as our equals. And those who we treat perhaps as maybe not our equals. We still respect people, don't we? Okay? So, when you come across the word fear connected with God in the Psalms and the Proverbs and the Ecclesiastes, it's not the fear that cringes, expecting to be judged or criticised or blamed. It's a respect, a healthy respect, because he is the first cause, he is the one that has the power to do whatever he wills with us, to have us with him for eternity, or to take our life. It's in his hand. But our destiny is in our hand. Because we can determine that today by the way we live and how we interact one with the other, as we're going to see in a moment in John. I just lost Ecclesiastes for a minute, but just bear with me, I'll just get it back. And so, here we go. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole, now the AV says, the whole duty of man, that's not in the original. If you were to translate that today, we would perhaps put it, for this completes the man. This makes the man complete. Now, what did Jesus teach us was the greatest commandment? Can anybody remember?
Love the Lord your God.
Say it loudly, Phil.
Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and
strength. Okay, does anybody know where we find that verse quickly? Matthew 22? Hop over to Matthew 22, let's have a look. This is one of those little
not so little, one of those large questions that was like a chestnut, it was hard to crack. And disciples loved putting these questions to the rabbis to see how the rabbis would answer. Said, Lord, the Jews had 613 laws in just their average commandments without looking at their Mishnah and so on. So what is the greatest commandment? They came to Jesus and asked him in verse 36, Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Now, Solomon has just told us to fear God and keep his commandments. Which one? Well, Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. You shall love your neighbour, how? As yourself. Didn't say you shall love your neighbour instead of yourself. He said you shall love your neighbour just like you love yourself. Okay? Now the other verse I'm thinking of that tells us that we're incomplete is in 2 Timothy 3. Just, you know, hop over and have a look at this one. 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17. And here we read in verse 16 for context. Timothy's just been told by Paul that he's known the scriptures from a child. All scripture is given by the inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, instruction in righteousness, that the man, read there women too if you're a woman, of God may be perfect, truly furnished unto all good works. Now what's the word perfect there really mean? Anybody know? Can you read the word perfect? Be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. What's that a call to? What's perfection? Completeness. We would use the word perhaps today, maturity. So when Jesus says in Matthew 6, is it, be perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect, he's saying be growing up about the issues of life. Look at things in a growing up way. Don't deal with problems in your life like you did when you were a child back in kindergarten in the sandpit. Now a lot of you here haven't heard Michael Dewey's exhortation about how we learn most of what we need to learn in life in the sandpit. And perhaps one day Mike might share that exhortation again with us. But we do, don't we, Mike? We learn most of what we need to know in life in the sandpit. But we've got to grow up and get out of the sandpit and put into practice in our lives the things that are most needful for us to be mature, to deal with things the way that God would deal with them. The word mature means to be complete or grown up. You see, a baby, like little Samuel back here, he's at a point in his life, right at this moment, where he can only receive love. He doesn't give love. Okay? All he does, if you were to watch that baby, all he does is sleep and suck. Right? He's a big sucker. Right? He hangs on to mum and he gets his nourishment. And he sucks and he sucks and he sucks and then something happens the other end and mum's got a job to do and she still loves him. He creates a lot of work for his parents. And for the first few months in a little boy's life, as famous as it was in all of our lives, we were totally, absolutely, 100% helpless. We can only draw attention to our needs by crying out. And Sarah, being a third-time mum, will know probably that there are around about 6 or 7 cries that a baby has. It's a universal language. All babies know it from birth. It's part of their instinct, part of what they are born with. And they use that inbuilt baby language to communicate their different needs and to let you know that they have issues that need to be met. So here's a question. What's the very first thing a mother or father must do in order to love such an unloving creature? What's the first thing we've got to do when a baby that comes into our family?
Love yourself.
Well, that's part of the issue, but what's the thing we've got to do with the baby?
Understand.
Yeah, before we even understand it.
Bond with
it. Accept it. Bond it. That was the other word I was thinking of, okay?
So to be sure, the baby is lovable and lovely, but nonetheless, initially, it is unloving. So the first thing we must do as that baby comes into our family is that we must accept it, then nurture it, then love it, then cuddle it, then clean it, then clothe it, then feed it. This is all part of bringing a person or a baby into a family. Some of you might be able to see where I'm going to go with this. In other words, Mum and Dad, Crandy and Sarah, must accept or love that baby just as they would wish to be accepted and loved if they were in the same circumstance 25, 30 years ago. Okay? So the way that you would want to be treated as a baby is the way that you will learn to treat that baby. Is that right? Okay, you wouldn't want to treat your baby any different to the way that you were treated. Okay. Come back into Matthew 22 and have a look at these great commandments that Jesus has given us. I'm going to read this with a slightly different twist. Verse 36, Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Jesus said unto him, you shall accept the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it, you shall accept your neighbour as yourself. You see what I've done? For putting the emphasis on acceptance as being the fulfilling of love, we take away from the duty. Right? A lot of Christians feel that they have to love other people because it's our Christian duty. We've got to do it. Jesus told us that we have to love people. No, I can't stand the sight of that person. I'm away. Right? Be honest. We've got people that we find are very hard to like. I might be one of them for you. Thank you for tolerating me. I go places now where I'm celebrated, not tolerated. But the whole point is, here at Pine Rivers, we have learned to accept people where they are on their journey. Why have we done that? Why is that part of our mission statement? Because that empowers people. Why else? It makes them feel as though they belong, and they do. Why else? It validates them. Yes. Why else? Why else would we do that? Why would we accept people where they are on their journey at this time? Because God does. That is the whole point. God does it for us. Let's go back to 1 John chapter 4 and let's read that now in the light of this new understanding. 1 John 4 and verse 19. We accept him, that is, speaking about God, because he first accepted us. If a man say, I accept God, and yet at the same time hate his brother, he is what? He's a liar. For John says, he that accepts not his brother whom he can see, how can he accept God whom he has not seen? And this commandment have we from him, that he who accepts God must accept his brother also. Now, this morning was a bit of a shabbat at the start of the meeting, and I really wanted Phil to read Ephesians 5 from the Message, and I'm not going to do that for you now, but if you do have a message, take the time to read Ephesians 5 out of the Message. But I just want to share with you a few verses that are relevant at this point. Ephesians 5, verses 1 to 4. Watch what God does, and then you do it, says Paul. Like children who learn proper behaviour from their parents. Mostly what God does is accept you. will love you. Keep company with him and learn a life of acceptance. Observe how Christ accepted us. His acceptance of us is not cautious, but is extravagant. Jesus or God don't accept us in order to get something from us, but to give everything of themselves to us. Accept others just like that, says Paul in Ephesians. I'm going to go now to the end of the chapter and verse 25. Somebody just helped me here. How does verse 25 start in an AB? Husbands, right. Okay, so here we go. Husbands, go all out in the acceptance of your wives, exactly as Christ accepted the church. An acceptance that is marked by giving, not getting. Christ's acceptance of us makes the church whole. It fills the hole in our soul. Like the wind just blowing the papers around. His words evoke her beauty. Everything he does and says is designed to bring out the best out of her, dressing her in dazzling white silk, radiant with holiness. And that's how we husbands ought to accept our wives. They're really doing themselves a favour, since they're already one in marriage. Now here's the point. Paul says, no one abuses his own body, does he? No, he feeds and tenders it. That's how Christ treats us, the church, since we're part of his body. And this is why a man leaves father and mother and cherishes his wife. They're no longer two, they become one flesh. This is a huge mystery, and I don't pretend to understand it all, and neither do I. I'm following Paul's lead there. What is clearest to me is the way that Christ treats the church. And this provides a good picture of how each husband ought to treat his wife, accepting himself in accepting her. And this and how each wife is to honour or respect her husband. So, I read this today in a catalogue that came to me from the Word magazine. A little crazy about a book, which I would like to go and buy. And this is what it says. Every relationship of value is built upon a foundation of trust, not behavioural skills. So take trust out of any element, any relationship we have, and we've got a problem. Now I'm going to give an extreme example. I'm going to use Cranley as an example. Cranley is a Top Gun pilot. He works for Sunstate and he flies aeroplanes packed with people. If I did not trust him to successfully land that aeroplane at the other end, am I going to hop on the plane this end? No way. I mean, I take my hats off to those guys that hopped out of the Garuda aeroplane in Indonesia and hopped back on another one to fly back to Jakarta. I mean, that just took guts to do that. Would you trust a pilot who had made such a mess of such a landing, so simple on a beautiful day apparently, but they ran off into a rice paddy at the end and how many died? 21 people? Just like that? You know? Absolutely awesome. So, when I drive down the road, I've got to trust that everybody else coming towards me is going to stay on the right side of the road, don't I? When I come to a set of traffic lights, I've got to trust that everybody knows what green means and what yellow means and what red means. Here in Queensland, green means go fast, yellow means go faster, and red means the guy behind us got to stop. I worked that out a long time ago. Well, that's not quite right, is it? So we've got to trust people, don't we? So we're human beings, not human doings. And we get so mixed up with that. Like the lawyer that came to Jesus and said, good master, what good thing must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus came back and he says, I want you to be like a man who you would regard as a Samaritan, who you will have nothing to do with, who got down off his donkey and put himself out to help you, the man in the gutter. And Jesus was identifying himself with the Samaritan. He is saying, he was actually saying, when you need help, are you going to accept help from me, even though you regard me as being a Samaritan, a half-breed,
not one of yourselves, not acceptable. He's the man we've come to remember here this morning. You see, he was rejected, so he knows how to love those who are rejected. He was cast out, so he knows how to love those who are cast out. He was despised of men, so he knows how to love those that are despised of men. Why did Jesus not have a hole in his soul? Because he knew his Father totally accepted him, and Jesus totally accepted who he was. He loved himself. Not in a narcissistic sense of looking in the mirror and preening every hair on your head. He loved the calling that the Father had given him. And that's our challenge. He knew what his mission was. In an environment of acceptance, we experience the safety of being able to open our hearts to one another. Why is it that we so often feel that we can talk over very important things with another person who is an absolute, total stranger to us? You know, in a past life, I used to spend hundreds of dollars on marriage counselling. I didn't know these people from a bar of soap, most of them. Some of them were in the meeting. But in those counselling sessions, most of them were people that I had never met and have never met since. And yet we're quite happy to open our hearts up and pour our deepest sorrows and deepest worries and deepest concerns out to a person that we've never ever met before. Why do we do that? Well, they accept us. They don't judge us. They don't criticise us. They don't blame us. They don't cast us away or cast us aside or cast us out. They don't reject us. They can't afford to. You wouldn't go back, would you? I mean, you will only go back to a place where you feel good. If Dreamworld didn't feel good for kids, do you think mums and dads could get kids to go to Dreamworld? No way. If the kids came home and said, "Mum, Dad, don't ever take me to that place again, and I'm going to tell all my friends at school that the place sucks," what is going to happen to Dreamworld? Down the tube. Right? So we will only keep coming back to places that we are accepted. If we are not accepted, we will not come back. Is that right, Sarah? I know that you know that that's right. You know, we've got people in this room who understand what it is to be rejected by others. We learn from that. We learn very, very quickly that some places are safe and some places are not safe. I want you to share with you another verse in 1 Samuel 18. This is absolutely delightful. 1 Samuel 18. We've got a brother in this room who absolutely loves David. David the king, he's his mentor. Well, here's David's friend. Look at what it says of Jonathan. In 1 Samuel 18, verse 11, it came to pass when he made an end of speaking unto Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and these are the words, and Jonathan accepted David as himself. In other words, a true friend is another one of us. Right? My wife here is my best friend. Right? She's another one of me. We think alike. The things that we both like doing, we have in common. And so we both like doing those things together, hopping in the car and just going off for a drive on a Saturday, just for the fun of it, just because we can. Okay? Reading books. Whatever it might be. Your friends are another you in some form. And so therefore they love you as they love themselves. Now Jonathan had a son. His name was what? Saul. What was Saul's problem?
Love himself.
He just couldn't get it.
And so where David and Jonathan were knit together because Jonathan loved himself, and so therefore was able to love David, or who David was, Saul got everything in a knot because the maidens, when David came back from fighting, sang David slaying his 10,000s while Saul's just slaying his thousands. And Saul got jealous and said, what more can he have? He'll want the kingdom next. Well, Jonathan didn't care. He was happy to let David have the kingdom. Because belongings was not Jonathan's thing. Belonging was. How did Saul deal with David? Picked up a javelin and what? Twice. He threw that javelin with incredible power to pin David to the wall like a fly. But David knew enough about Saul's psyche to see when he reached down to pick that javelin to make a beeline for that door and not come back. So Jonathan loved David because he loved himself. What about John 3:16? We know the verse, don't we? God so accepted the world that he gave his only begotten son. That's why we can eat and drink of these emblems this morning. That's why we can share in the great things that he is doing for the future. Because he accepted us while we were still unacceptable. Is that good news? How was Jesus able to accept us when we were unacceptable? He accepted who he was. He loved himself. Not in a narcissistic sense, but in the sense that Jonathan's soul was knit to David because he loved him as his own soul. In John 13, verses 34 to 35, have a look at these verses. John 13. Another brother in this room that just loves those verses. He quoted them the other night at our Grace Awakening class. Verse 34 to 35. A new commandment I give unto you, said Jesus, that you accept one another as I have accepted you. That you also accept one another. And by this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you have all the doctrines correct. Doesn't say that. It says, by this shall you know you are my disciples if you love or accept one another as I have accepted you. What did the law say? Tara? Love your neighbour as yourself. What does Jesus say? Love your neighbour as I have loved you. That raises things up a notch, doesn't it? So now I accept people not as I accept myself. I accept people as Jesus has accepted you and me. How did he accept you and me? He accepted us when we were altogether unacceptable. You see, we're accepted by one. We're going to remember him in a moment with the eating of the bread and drinking of the wine. We're accepted by one who had no need to be first loved by us that he might love it all. Remember John? God first loved us even when we were unlovely. You see, God is love, isn't he? He is acceptance. He accepts us on our journey where we are. The Bible doesn't say God has love. Remember in Exodus 3, it says, I am that I am. Now I know there are other explanations, I will be who I will be, and the Yahweh name and all of that. Not getting into that, let's just take the English, I am that I am. What's that saying? God is secure in his own love, in his own acceptance. He doesn't need us to love him for him to feel good. He is good. He is God. He is good. In Deuteronomy 7 verses 7 to 9. We won't go there because we're running out of time. But Israel was told, I love you because... Why did God love Israel?
No.
I love you because...
I accept you.
That's it. That's the only reason God had. I love you because I love you. It's very simple. Because he can. He didn't love them because they were a great and mighty nation. He didn't love them because they got everything morally right and they were perfect in what they believed. They were a pack of rat bags. Down just like we are. Down there in Egypt. And he went down and he loved them because he loved them. See, God's love is not centered on himself or on any other created thing or being. And that's the key for us. Self-acceptance or self-love is centered on God and Christ. Only they provide reasons big enough to fill the hole in our soul. No other human being or no other created thing is big enough to complete us. Jesus accepts me, therefore I accept myself. Jesus loves me, therefore I love myself. And we know that Jesus loves us unconditionally. And I was going to discuss that a little further, but we won't because we're running out of time. So marriage, for most of us, can provide a part of the completeness that we on our own may feel that we lack. But if we cannot accept our marriage partners, for example, in the same way as we accept ourselves, or if they cannot accept us in the way that they accept themselves, or, and this is the most common scenario, and I'll bring this back to a personal level, if I cannot accept who I am, then I will find it impossible to accept who you are. If I cannot accept who I am, then I will find it impossible to accept who you are. So marriage in those circumstances only compounds the problems and doesn't diminish them. It's true that a problem shared is a problem halved, but that's only true if when sharing the problem, one is able to trust that one is still accepted and loved in spite of the problem. Okay? If we don't feel that we can talk to somebody else and to trust that we will still be loved after that exchange, then we've got some work to do in that relationship. Maybe a good reason why in days of old, Jacob, Isaac and the ancients were men who were, in our estimation, quite elderly before they got married. Because it takes time to find out who you are. And it's at this point now I want you to take down a piece of paper and a pen, and I'm going to be quiet for a couple of moments. And I want you to write down the answer to this question for yourself. This is the question. It's you who is asking the question, not me. Who am I? Okay. You ask yourself that question and write it down on a piece of paper. Who am I? Once upon a time, if somebody had asked me that question, I would have written something like this. I'm Cliff York, the son of Ron York.
an ex-farmer from Western Australia who has a love for God. But that's not a who am I, that's a what am I. The girls are better at this than the boys. The girls know who they are long before us fellas ever wake up to who we are. It's a real challenge in relationships. The girls become awake. In the Bible sense, awake long before us men wake up to who we are. Is there anybody here who'd like to share who they are?
I just have it on me.
Okay. Graham said?
No, I never accepted.
He's the first person he ever accepted. That's right. You're him. Yeah. Anyone else?
Accepted by God and Christ.
That's right. You are a being that's accepted by God and Christ. And you what for yourself, Phil? You accept who you are, don't you? In Christ. And that doesn't mean to say we can't improve. The first stage of self-development is to understand who we are. And it's upon that then that we can build who we will be for eternity. But we will be basically the people that we are today, with all the rough edges knocked off, hopefully, in immortality. Anyone else like to share who they are? Don't be shy. There's no right or wrong.
I'm a child of God. God has accepted me. I'm secure in his love.
Beautiful. I am a child of God. God has accepted me. I am secure in his love. Okay. Think about that. Talk about it with your family, partners, whatever, when you get home. But we are unable to love or accept others often because we have not learned to love or accept ourselves. We cannot learn to love or accept ourselves because we are not loved or accepted by others, or perhaps we're unable to accept their love for us. We're not loved or accepted by others because we're unable to love or accept them, or we only love or accept them out of a sense of Christian or family duty. And so the cycle goes back to the beginning. We are unable to love or accept others because we have not learned to love or accept ourselves. So with apologies to Eugene Peterson and the message, I'm going to finish with a reading this morning from 1 Corinthians 13, and if you want to follow in the AV, you'll find this is very different. If I speak with human eloquence and angelic ecstasy, but don't accept others in the same way I myself would wish to be accepted, I'm nothing but the creaking of a rusty gate. If I speak God's word with power, revealing all his mysteries and making everything plain as day, and if I have faith that says to a mountain, jump and it jumps, but I don't accept others in the same way I myself would wish to be accepted, I'm nothing. If I give everything I own to the poor and even go to the stake to be burned as a martyr, but I don't accept others in the same way I myself would wish to be accepted, I've got nowhere. So, no matter what I say, what I believe and what I do, I'm bankrupt if I don't accept others in the same way I myself would wish to be accepted. I accept others as I accept myself means that I will never give up. To accept others as I accept myself means that I care more for others than for myself. To accept others as I accept myself means that I won't want what I don't have. To accept others as I accept myself means I don't strut around with a swelled head, forcing myself onto others. To accept others as I accept myself means that it is never me first. It means I do not fly off the handle, and it means I don't keep score of the sins of others. To accept others as I accept myself means I do not revel when others grovel, but instead it means that I take pleasure in the flowering of truth. To accept others as I accept myself means that I can put up with many things because I trust God always, because he alone can fill the hole in my soul. To accept others as I accept myself means that I will always look for the best in others. It means that I will never look back to the things that have happened to me in the past. It means that I will never look back to bring up the things that have happened to me in the past.
It means instead that I am empowered to keep going to the end. This choice to accept others just as I accept myself will never die. In fact, Paul said in Romans 15, accept others in just the same way that Christ has accepted you, to the glory of the Father. Continuing in Corinthians, Paul says, we only know a portion of the truth, and what we say about God is always incomplete. But when the complete one, the one who can truly fill the hole in my soul, arrives, the hole in my soul will be filled up. When I was an infant on my mother's breast, I gurgled and cooed like any infant. When I grew up, I left those infant ways for good, having learned to love and accept myself. We don't see things clearly yet. We're squinting in a fog, peering through a mist. But it won't be long before the weather clears and the sun shines bright. We'll see it all then. See it all as clearly as God sees us, knowing him correctly just as he knows us. But for right now, until the hole in our soul is filled up, we have three things to focus on to lead us toward that consummation. One, trust steadily in God, just as an infant trusts steadily in its parents' acceptance. Hope unswervingly to the end, accepting that God accepts us right now, and love extravagantly, authentically accepting others just the way you yourself would like to be authentically accepted and validated and received and confirmed and believed and acknowledged and understood and recognized and celebrated. The best of these three, said Jesus, is to love one another in just the same way as I have accepted you.